You're listening to the free abridged edition of the Energy Transition Show.
Oil, coal, hydro, nuclear energy, natural gas,
energy infrastructure,
solar power,
wind turbines.
Can nuclear be a part of meeting our climate challenge?
Absolutely not.
The money that's being spent on nuclear is crowding out viable, less costly solutions for decarbonizing the power sector.
For March 6th, 2024, this is the Energy Transition Show with Chris Nelder. In episode 209, we reviewed the history of nuclear power, beginning with its origins in the nuclear weapons industry. That discussion detailed how the civilian nuclear power industry was built on a foundation of lies, and has always been, and continues to be, just a fig leaf for the nuclear weapons industry. But in its own right, the nuclear power industry shares the nuclear weapons industry's long history of deceit, excess, conceit, and failure, with its high costs, toxic wastes, geopolitical security risks, and inflexibility. Nuclear power never made any sense as a power generation technology. If the nuclear power industry had to rely on private sector investment and compete with other power generation technologies on a level playing field, in the absence of a nuclear weapons industry, no one would have ever built a single nuclear power plant. Nuclear power is even more nonsensical today, with costs that are multiples higher than solar and wind power generation, and no hope of being financed by the private sector. Only governments, by justification of their nuclear weapons programs, are still pursuing nuclear power, and forcing its excessive costs and risks onto the public through a variety of political and propaganda efforts. Most recently, those efforts have consisted of peddling illusions and wild promises about the potential for small modular reactors, or SMRs. A few years ago, SMR boosters were assuring us that a new nuclear renaissance was on its way because the ability to mass produce smaller reactors would drive their costs well below the costs of conventional large reactors, and further, they'd be more operationally flexible and better suited to pairing with variable renewables. Now, with the most promising and well-funded SMR developers imploding, it's increasingly obvious that all of that was just another pile of lies, promulgated by the same interests who have always backed nuclear power. To walk us through the most recent data and chronicle the ongoing failure of SMRs, we are joined today by Jim Green, the National Nuclear Free Campaigner with Friends of the Earth Australia. Jim is also a member of the Nuclear Consulting Group and former editor of the World Information Service on Energy's Nuclear Monitor newsletter. He has closely followed the nuclear industry for some 30 years now as a journalist and campaigner, and he brings to the conversation a wealth of experience and knowledge about the nuclear power industry's long history of failure and deceit. We'll review the track record of the conventional nuclear power industry over the past couple of decades. We'll explore the latest data on nuclear power plant construction and retirements around the world. And we'll take a close look at each of the companies that have been trying to build SMRs in recent years. Then in the news segment, we'll review the news about layoffs at SMR developer NuScale. We'll note yet more delays and cost overruns for the UK's Hinkley Point C nuclear plant. We'll recognize the astonishing pace of wind and solar deployment in China last year and the likely decline of its emissions this year. We'll toll the bell for hydrogen refueling stations in California. And we'll celebrate the wheels of justice finally turning for several key co-conspirators in the Ohio HB6 corruption scandal. And now, our conversation with Jim Green, recorded February 5th, 2024. So let's bring him into the conversation now. Welcome, Jim, to the Energy Transition Show.
Thanks, Chris.
So how long have you been following nuclear?
About 30 years. I did an honours degree in public health, and I was looking around for a PhD topic, which was interesting and topical and had some connection to my interest in public health. And there was a debate in Australia at that time over the replacement of our only nuclear research reactor, so I chose to do my PhD on that topic. And then after that, I was involved in campaigning. I moved back to South Australia to help Aboriginal people stop the imposition of a nuclear waste dump, and I've been involved in nuclear issues ever since then, with Friends of the Earth primarily as the National Nuclear Campaigner for Australia. And for 6 or 7 years, I was the editor of the Nuclear Monitor newsletter, which is produced by NIRS in the United States, the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, and also by WISE, which is based in Amsterdam. That's the World Information Service on Energy.
Okay. Wow. So you've been actually following the nuclear industry and its various iterations and evolutions for three decades.
That's right.
All right. Well, you recently wrote an article in which you did the math on nuclear reactor startups and closures in recent years globally. Why don't you share that data with our listeners?
Yeah, well, as we just mentioned, I've been following nuclear issues for 30 years, but at one level, there's been very little to follow because nuclear power has been stagnant for 30 years. Whether you measure it in capacity or nuclear generation, there's been next to no change whatsoever. But if we drill into the data a bit, it's quite interesting. Over the past 20 years, there were 102 power reactor startups and 104 closures. But of those, 49 of the reactor startups were in China, where they've had no closures. And in the rest of the world, there's been a net decline of 51 reactors. So we can see one of the important patterns there. It's growing in China and declining in the rest of the world. And even though nuclear power has been stagnant for 30 years, there is one big difference, which is that 30 years ago, in 1990, the mean age of the global power reactor fleet was just 11.3 years, and now that figure has nearly tripled. The mean age of the reactor fleet is 31.4 years, which is quite old in the context of the lifespan of a nuclear power reactor. So we've got an aging fleet of reactors. And because the fleet is aging, the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, anticipates the closure of 10 reactors per year, or 10 gigawatts of capacity, over the coming decades. And so the industry will need to average about 10 reactor construction starts and 10 reactor startups just to maintain that pattern of stagnation, let alone to achieve any growth. So that's the broad picture, is that nuclear power has been stagnant and the reactor fleet is aging.
Great. Okay. So by contrast to this global picture of nuclear stagnation for the past 30 years, renewables are growing quite strongly, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right. If we look at last year's figures, nuclear power capacity declined by 1.7 gigawatts. So that's a marginal decline. But renewable capacity grew by 507 gigawatts, which is 50% more than it grew in the previous year. And as the International Energy Agency noted in its recent Renewables 2023 report, this is the 22nd year in a row that renewable capacity additions have set a new record. And in terms of contribution to global electricity supply, renewables have grown to 30.2%. And the IEA expects renewables to reach 42% by the year 2028. So we're in the midst of significant growth, and that growth is set to expand. And conversely, nuclear power has been stagnant in terms of generation and capacity, but its contribution to global electricity supply has been declining. It reached a peak of 17.5% in 1996. And now it's barely half that figure. It's down to 9.2%. So it's 30.2% renewables and growing, 9.2% for nuclear and declining.
Right. Okay. And in fact, by 2026, the IEA expects wind and solar individually will both pass nuclear power as a share of generation. So that's a pretty stark contrast. And part of the reason for the net decline in nuclear generation globally is that conventional reactor projects in recent years have been slow and expensive to complete, haven't they?
Yeah, that's right. It's been an absolute disaster for the industry. If we cast our minds back to the late 2000s, there was all that talk about a nuclear power renaissance. And for a few years, there looked like there might be some reality to that. For a three-year period, they averaged 12 reactor construction starts. And that was a recipe for modest growth. And if they built on that to achieve, say, 15, 20 reactor starts per year, then you could have had a renaissance. But it didn't eventuate for three reasons. One is the Fukushima disaster. The other is catastrophic cost overruns with reactor projects. And the third is that while the cost of renewables has been decreasing exponentially, the cost of reactors has been increasing exponentially. And there are plenty of examples of that. Probably the most dramatic come from the United States. There was really just two new reactor construction projects. One was in South Carolina, and that was for two AP1000 reactors. And Westinghouse led that project, but that was abandoned in 2017 after $9 billion was wasted on the project. And Westinghouse filed for bankruptcy, and Westinghouse's parent company, Toshiba, only survived by selling off its most profitable assets. And the other construction project in the US was the Vogtle project in Georgia. Again, that was two AP1000 reactors. And the cost of that doubled. When they began construction, the estimate was around $15 billion for two reactors. The latest cost estimate is about $35 billion. And it's interesting to follow these cost estimates. As I mentioned, if you measure the recent cost estimates with the estimates at the time when construction began, you find this pattern where cost estimates double. But also, if we look at the early promotional cost estimates in the US and elsewhere, they increased by a factor of 10. So in 2006, Westinghouse said it could build an AP1000 reactor for as little as $1.4 billion. But the latest estimate is about $17 billion. So it's increased by a factor of 10. And this is what I call the golden rule of nuclear economics, which is that you can add a zero to industry estimates.
I mean, it makes you wonder how they could possibly get their estimates so wrong. And for the benefit of our listeners who might be fairly new to the program, we covered those projects that you just mentioned, the VC Summer project in South Carolina and the Vogtle project in Georgia, and a few failed big CCS projects that similarly vaporized billions of taxpayer dollars for nothing, way back in episode 62 of this podcast. But the cost and schedule overruns of conventional nuclear power plants aren't unique to the U.S., are they?
That's right. The UK is another striking example. It's been in the media recently. In the late 2000s, the French utility EDF was saying they could build one EPR reactor in the United Kingdom for about £2 billion or $2.5 billion. But the latest cost estimates for the two EPR reactors that are being built in the UK are 10 times greater. An extraordinary cost overruns. And once again, you can add a zero to the early promotional industry estimates. And if you look at the estimates when construction began, you can double those estimates. So this is a recurring pattern. And it's useful to remember when you're looking at any nuclear industry estimates, because we see that pattern repeating time and time again.
Are things any better in France? Because that's often held up as sort of the poster child of a successful nuclear fleet.
No, things are no better in France. And in both the UK and France, they haven't started up any new reactors this century. You have to go back to the 1990s for their last reactor startups. And in France, there's just one reactor under construction. And again, it's one of these EPR reactors. And the latest cost estimate is 19 billion euros or 20 billion US, and that's around about six times greater than the original estimates. So it's been an absolute disaster, and that reactor has been under construction for 16 years and it still hasn't been completed. So that bridges into another of these important topics, is could nuclear power make a difference in any timely fashion? And from the experiences in the US, the UK, France and elsewhere, the answer is a flat no. It's taking them forever to get these projects off the ground. It's taking an awful long time to build the reactors. And the industry's only hope is that they can improve on past performance. But it's not going to make a timely contribution to climate change mitigation.
I mean, do you have any concept of why these nuclear developers are consistently undershooting the actual cost by 10x and consistently undershooting the actual project schedule by a multiple as well? Like, do they not know how long it takes and how much it costs?
Well, I think probably the most important answer to that question is that they lie. I mean, it's in their interest to lie, and to get government subsidies, they have to lie. To get public support, they have to lie. So they lie all day long. And the nuclear industry is particularly adept at lying. They've been doing it forever. A more generous answer would be that so few reactors were built in the West, say from the late 90s through the 2000s, that they had no idea how long it would take them to build these reactors or how much they would cost. They were just guessing, and their guesses have proven to be out by multiples.
Well, a consistent pattern of lying is certainly consistent with the story that we heard in our last episode on nuclear power in episode 209. It seems that the whole history of the industry is built on a foundation of lies, essentially.
Absolutely. The industry is renowned for its deceit, and it takes me back to when I was doing my PhD thesis 30 years ago, and I was so shocked. I had no idea about the industry's pattern of deceit. And in Australia, it was a government agency that wanted to build a new nuclear research reactor, and I assumed that a government agency would be at least halfway honest, but they weren't, and they didn't need to be because they had government support. The government wasn't holding the industry accountable for its lies. The government was parroting the industry's lies, and unfortunately, we can see that around the world. It's quite a pattern.
Interesting. So, given this really dreadful track record, what do you make of this pledge signed by 22 countries at COP28 to triple nuclear power capacity by 2050? We hope you've enjoyed this free sample of the Energy Transition Show. Our full episodes cover much more and are typically 60 to 90 minutes long. When you become a full annual subscriber, you'll get 2 new complete episodes each month, access to our entire back catalog, extensive show notes, interview transcripts, the text of the news items for each episode, and access to our exclusive job board. Your premium members-only subscription will work in all apps and players that support podcast feeds, including Apple Podcasts and Pocket Casts, so you can easily listen from your mobile device on the go. The first 33 episodes of the Energy Transition Show were free, and always will be, so if you want to see what our full shows contain, feel free to check those out. Then we hope you'll become a member and support our show. In order to bring you the most unfiltered, unbiased, honest information possible, we have elected not to take any sponsors or advertisers. The Energy Transition Show is entirely supported by listener subscriptions. To become a subscriber and enjoy our full offerings, just point your browser to energytransitionshow.com and click the Become a Member button. Annual subscriptions, which include full access to our entire back catalog of full-length episodes, are just $60 a year. Monthly subscriptions are $6.99 a month and give you access to the 2 most recent episodes. Single episodes can be purchased for $7 each. We also offer discounted annual subscriptions for individual university students and professors, as well as group licenses for companies, nonprofits, and universities. So join us today and support our ad-free podcast featuring high-quality, cutting-edge interviews and news about the most important story of our time, energy transition. And now a quick look at some recent news items. Item 1. As we mentioned in passing in the interview, leading SMR developer NuScale Power laid off nearly a third of its workforce on January 5th, following the mutual decision with its prospective customers to abandon its flagship pilot project in Idaho in November. No new projects have been announced since then. NuScale went public with a SPAC in 2022 and received $600 million in federal backing for its technology, but has been unable to convince any utilities to actually buy it. At the end of September, the company reported having $117 million in cash and short-term investments. After trading at a high of nearly $16 per share in 2022, the stock closed at $2.52 as of this writing. For more on NuScale, listen to episode 209, news item 4 of episode 211, and news item 1 of episode 214. For more on SPACs and why they were always going to end in tears for retail investors, listen to episode 144. Item 2. Hinkley Point C, the nuclear power plant that has been under construction in the UK, announced yet more delays and cost overruns in January. The completion date for Unit 1 has now been moved to roughly 2031, or 5 years later than... Well, that's it for this episode of the Energy Transition Show. Thanks for listening. You can find our show archive and give us feedback and suggestions at energytransitionshow.com. On social media, you can follow us on Mastodon at transitionshow@mastodon.energy or on Twitter at transitionshow. Chris Nelder creates the show, Kevin Melsheimer edits it and makes us all sound brilliant, and Justin Ritchie produces our listener experience. Mike Sugar composed and produced our theme music, and you can find him at mikesugarmusic.com. The Energy Transition Show is a production of the XE Network.